Welcome to another episode of New Books in Islamic Studies. I'm your host, Elliot Bazzano. For every program, we choose a new and exciting book and chat with the author. Today, I have the pleasure of speaking with Michael Burkle, professor of religion at Earlham College, about his exciting edited volume, Quran in Conversation, published by Baylor University Press in 2014. Quran in Conversation challenges the reader to think deeply about the Quran. The book will likely leave the reader with many answers, but also many questions. By drawing on academic scholars, imams, lawyers, and activists, this edited volume presents a series of compelling, masterfully written, digestible, and personal accounts of the Quran. It addresses tough questions about violence, gender, interfaith relations, and authority, but not in an apologetic manner. The authors make clear that the Quran is not merely an old text, but a living text, teeming with evolving interpretations and debates. Because all the writers are based in the United States, the text seamlessly incorporates discussions of the Quran with contemporary issues in American culture. It thus becomes clear that the Quran is an American text, as well as an Arabic text and a Muslim text. The chapters are arranged thematically, and one could reasonably read them sequentially or not, depending on the purpose. The text, therefore, offers a range of pedagogical functions and is sure to benefit classroom use, especially because of its readable and erudite prose. Burkle has set a high bar for future edited volumes that follow models anything like Quran in Conversation. I hope you enjoy the interview, and without further ado, here is my conversation with Professor Michael Burkle. Good morning, Professor Burkle. Thank you so much for joining us today to talk about your book, Quran in Conversation. And I was hoping we could first start by talking about your educational background. So where did you go to school? Who are some influential mentors? And how did you get interested in the topic that led to this edited volume?
Great. Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be your guest. So thank you for inviting me. As far as my educational background, I think the first thing to say is that I am not trained as a scholar of Islam. And we can say more about that as our conversation unfolds. My background is actually in the history of Christianity. I did my doctorate at Harvard University, and some important people in my intellectual development would be Margaret Miles, who was there at the time, George Hunston Williams, who was still alive and teaching at that point, and across the street at the Weston School of Theology, I also studied with Professor Brian Daly, a very excellent scholar of ancient Christianity. So that's where I began. However, I teach at a small liberal arts college, and at a small college, one can end up teaching widely. And the focus of my, as I said, the focus of my usual research is not writing about Islam. But some years ago, the religion department here at Earlham College agreed among ourselves that, especially in these times, we needed to do more teaching about Islam. To me, as a teacher, teaching is about truth-seeking and truth-telling. And I also believe that teaching can be a kind of peacemaking. And as far as truth-telling, the full truth is not being told about Islam's about Islam and about Muslims generally in our media. There are misunderstandings that abound, and there are intentional misrepresentations. So I agreed to read a lot of books, to talk to some genuine scholars of Islam, people trained in that field. I learned some Quranic Arabic in order to be prepared to teach students about Islam. And because I teach about religions that are not my own, with respect and sympathy, often Muslim students will take courses with me. Their knowledge of Islam, of course, is very deep and very personal, but it may not be very wide. And Islam is, of course, very much a global faith. Well, some of these Muslim students came to me a while back and said, we think you should write something about Islam. And I thanked them for their spirit of generosity in saying this, but I also reminded them that I was not a trained scholar of Islam. I hardly felt qualified to do such a thing. And they replied, well, you explain us well, and we need sympathetic outsiders who understand us and can help others to understand us. We don't always seem to be completely effective in doing it from within the community. So I sat with that generous request, and it dawned on me that even though I was still not someone with a doctoral degree in the study of Islam, I could go and meet people who are scholars of Islam. And then, and that's really how this book began. I suppose some people could criticize this book in that the person who put it all together was not a trained scholar of Islam. But what I did was to go and talk to my Muslim neighbors, and in one sense, one goal of this book is to inspire readers to go and do the same. They don't have to be trained scholars of Islam to go meet their neighbors and talk about their faith.
Yeah, and I think anyone who looks through the book would be hard-pressed to challenge the erudition that went into putting it together and the diversity of perspectives that contributed the chapters. And so in that regard, how did you go about finding the scholars that you found? Because especially they're academic, non-academic, CIV imams, lawyers. What was that process like finding these different kinds of people to contribute to the book?
Well, that in itself was a wonderful exploration. I had been reading about Islam for some years, and so I knew who were some leading scholars. And so I began there, but then I continued to read widely. And as I got to know people, religious leaders and scholars within the Muslim community, some of them volunteered names. Oh, you should talk to so-and-so. I was hoping that the volume would reflect the broad spectrum that is Islam in North America. Close to half the speakers in the book are women. There are people from the Sunni tradition and the Shiite tradition. Some of my conversation partners, or my Muslim teachers, as I might call them in this book, some of them openly identify as Sufi. There are different racial and ethnic heritages that are included here, people of Middle Eastern background, people of South Asian heritage, particularly India or Pakistan. There are African-American voices. There are scholars who are converts to Islam, people of European ancestry. And so I was hoping that the book would have the richness that in some ways gives a sense of how broad and diverse the Muslim community in North America is.
Yeah, and you definitely encapsulate that very, very well. And so in terms of figuring out exactly what each contributor would write about, could you talk a little bit about the process for that? Was it something you suggested, something they proposed to you, a combination of the two?
Well, I would say that the I really only had one question. You might describe this as a project in listening. At least on my end, listening for me is at the heart of both teaching and learning, and that's the approach I took. I took listening as the center of my task in the work that resulted in this book. And as the project continued, that quality of listening on my part was mentioned by my conversation partners. But I really, as I said, only had one question. Would you please choose a passage from the Quran that means something to you and talk with me about it? Before I began, I had the idea, well, if they don't talk about topic A, B, and C, I will bring that up. But I had the good sense to abandon that idea before these interviews started, because I thought if a topic is important within the community, then it will arise in our conversations rather than be imposed by an outsider. And so there are some topics I hope would come forth, topics that people are misinformed or incompletely informed about Islam from our media. For example, Muslim understandings of the role of women, Muslim understandings of their relationship to non-Muslims, what is the meaning of jihad, what is the role of violence within Islamic ethics. Those were things that I hoped would be mentioned, and in fact they were, but they were mentioned because they came from the speakers themselves rather than being brought into the conversation by me.
Yeah, and I'd like to talk to you about this later on, how the book sort of functions pedagogically in that sense, in terms of its broad thematic scope. Like you said, there's so many of these hot button issues that it covers, but they come up organically in response to these different passages. So it's clear that when people are reading the text, there's lots of things going on in their mind. And so you mentioned that you had these conversations with the authors, and you know, that's the title of the book, Quran in Conversation. So could you say a little bit more about the topic, about the title, and how the Quran in Conversation says something deep and meaningful about the project?
Great question. The this book began in conversations, and I hope that it will inspire conversations among readers, or inspire readers who are non-Muslim to have conversations with their Muslim neighbors that they can go and meet. But I think, well, one of my speakers in the book described the Quran itself as a conversation. It is a conversation between God and the Prophet Muhammad. It is also a conversation in that there has been a long discussion from the very earliest times of Islam as to the meaning of the verses of the Quran. And so part of the experience for me was the experience of feeling invited into this discourse, this conversation that's been going on for 1,400 years about what these words mean, because scriptural words have particular kinds of power, and that power comes to life in different ways at different times and historical circumstances within the communities for whom this book is holy and authoritative.
So this idea of reading scripture and scripture or the Quran as a conversation, how exclusive do you think this is to reading the Quran versus other types of scripture as well?
Boy, great question. I love reading holy texts, and I love teaching scriptures from various traditions in my work as a teacher. I teach Hebrew scriptures. I have taught the New Testament. I teach Quran. I teach other foundational texts of other religious communities. And scriptures come alive within communities even as they give life to communities. And so I find this very powerful dynamic. It comes to life because of the kinds of reflection people bring to it, the kind of conversation they have about it within their community. And at the same time, the text itself lends vitality to the community. And it was a privilege to be present to that dynamic, because to engage in that as a member of a religious community, I think, requires great self-honesty. As a guest in that community, to witness that, for me, it was both intellectually fascinating as well as as well as spiritually enriching to see how that happens. Scriptures, I think, are best read with companions, as they have been for centuries and centuries. There are endless interpretations to the Quran, and I wanted to learn how this sacred text comes alive at this particular moment in this particular place. The Quran is not well known by non-Muslims, and I think would find reading the Quran unaccompanied to be a difficult task. As you know, it's not arranged chronologically. It's not arranged topically, and so it is best to approach the Quran with someone who has been reading it, who has been in that community of readers that has existed, as I said, for centuries and centuries. I think some of those questions of interpretation of the Quran are, how shall I say, matters among or between and among Muslims themselves. We mentioned some of them: the rights of women, the nature of jihad, the place of violence, attitudes toward non-Muslims. But these are they're similar questions, I think, in many religious communities. Perhaps the way to talk about the Quran is different, because traditional Islamic concept of revelation is somewhat different from that from many Christians and Jews, for example. And so there is a but I think there are similar dynamics, and certainly one of them is a matter, at least for the interpreter within the community, a matter of discernment, how to distinguish, if you believe there is a distinction to be made, how to distinguish between verses or a message that is a response to the particularities of the 7th century when the Quran was revealed, as opposed to what are the enduring principles of the Quran. This process of discernment, however, itself is not so unique. I think Christians have been doing this with their sacred texts. Jews are doing this with their holy scripture.
Right, so there's the issue of hermeneutics and how the Quran is distinct ontologically from other kinds of texts, and the arrangement of it. It's not chronological necessarily. It doesn't have storytelling. So these are certainly challenges that Muslims have faced over the years, right? And you mentioned that, you know, there's certain types of stereotypes people have about Islam and Muslims and the Quran today. And I think a lot of religious studies scholars, Islamic studies scholars, this is so obvious, it's part of their everyday life and teaching about the subject. For some of our listeners that might not be as aware of this challenge, could you say a little bit about how our socio-political context with the internet and various types of media adds to this challenge of being able to think about the Quran in a fair manner?
Well, certainly Muslims are, on the whole, are tend to be portrayed very negatively in our media. I don't know, I haven't seen the most recent numbers, but I remember that there was a study several years back that looked at, for example, images of Muslims in the media in North America, and 97% of them at that time were negative. 97% of them were extremist. And so what does that suggest to someone for whom that's their only source of information? Well, they would think that, well, I suppose 97% of Muslims must be extremist, which is, of course, completely wrong. And so there is a challenge of perceptions through the media. There is the challenge of the conflicts and wars that our country has been engaged in for the last nearly decade and a half now, and how that predisposes people There are, well, I haven't seen this movie, but there's recently released film about a sniper. And what I have been told by people who have seen the film is that the, even if it's not the primary intentional message of the film, for the protagonist in this movie, I think it takes place in Iraq, potentially every Muslim is an enemy. Every Muslim can kill you, and that's the image. If you see the film through the eyes of the protagonist, because that's where the way the sympathies are encouraged by the filmmaking, you could leave that film thinking every Muslim could be dangerous to me, even children, even mothers carrying infants. So they might have bombs with them, because apparently that's part of the film. So this is part of what we live with, and my hope is that the voices that have been gathered in this volume might show an alternative understanding of Islam in two ways. First, most of the Muslims we hear about in the news are extremists and from far away. I wanted people in this country to know who were mainstream is a complicated word, but I'll use that for the moment. Who are the mainstream Muslims, who are the overwhelming majority, and who are the Muslims who, what are the Muslims like who live here? What do they think? How do they feel? What is their ethical stance toward living in this society and being part of this project of creating the United States of America at this moment in history?
Right. So it's not just reading the news, but also watching movies and, you know, seeing images. So this stuff is really trapped in our mind. It's hard to, you know, move beyond these types of things. So violence, you mentioned, is one of these hot button issues. And since you also teach at a Quaker-affiliated institution, could you say something about how the authors in the volume explore the theme of violence and how that relates to concerns that you, your colleagues, your students might have in your institutional context particularly?
Sure. I teach at a Quaker college. I myself am a member of the Religious Society of Friends, the formal name of that group, known better by their nickname, the Quakers. I share a concern for promoting peace, peaceful understanding, and nonviolent interaction in the world. So clearly, that's part of who I am, and part of what motivated me to get to know my Muslim neighbors. A number of people in the book spoke very directly to questions of violence and to questions of what is the meaning of the term jihad, which you would know as a Muslim scholar doesn't fundamentally mean to engage in violent behavior, but rather to exert oneself, to make a struggle, to engage in an effort. One of my conversation partners in the book, Professor Jamal Badawi, spoke particularly about a verse that is easily misunderstood both within and beyond the Muslim community. And while when I spoke with him, it felt that in a sense two things were going on. And one was clearly he was explaining in a very generous and thoughtful way to me as an outsider how he understands these verses. But at the same time, I felt that he was engaged in an intra-Muslim dialogue, feeling that in some ways the conversation about these matters have been hijacked by extremists. And he wanted to show a very traditional way of interpreting the Quran. That if you're you yourself are a traditional Muslim, you can't argue with. And so he spoke with me how this verse, wherever you meet the infidels, slay them. Well, first of all, the word infidel there is never used to refer to Christians and to Christians or to Jews in the Quran. There are verses that are critical of Jews and Muslims, but Jews and Christians in the Quran. But for the most part, they are spoken of very positively with the honorific title, the people of the book. And so if it says slay the infidels by the use of the term infidels, or it really refers to 7th century Arabian polytheists. And as he pointed out, they're all dead now. And not even all of them, but it was to a particular subset of them who had betrayed a peace treaty with the Muslim community. And therefore, they were people who were engaging in acts that, as he put it, today would be considered war crimes. And so, first of all, the verse itself is limited to a very tiny population, and a very tiny population that, in fact, no longer historically exists. And so he was very eager to point out that even though this verse can be misinterpreted and has been abused both by some Muslim extremists as well as by non-Muslims who want to portray all Muslims as extremists, the Quran itself, as he pointed out, when you find a verse that seems to be in conflict with much of the rest of the message of the Quran, which he said is fundamentally about mercy, fundamentally about human justice, fundamentally about an effort to live in harmony with the divine and with other human beings. When you find a verse that seems to be in conflict with that, he said you interpret the few in light of the many. That's a traditional phrase among those who practice traditional Quranic interpretation, tafsir. So you interpret the few in light of the many. You interpret a verse like this in terms of the overwhelming message of the Quran, which is about mercy, God's mercy toward us, and therefore our emulating divine mercy in our experiences with one another to create a just and humane society. Another scholar with whom I spoke was Fazil Khan, by day a civil rights attorney, but his other vocation is very much to spread a generous and mercy-laden understanding of Islam, chiefly within the Muslim community. He goes out and meets with people. He doesn't just meet with, progressive college professors like me and say, this is the message of the Quran. He goes to Chechnya. He goes to places like Mindanao in the Philippines. He goes to, I don't know if he's been to Yemen, but he's been to other places where there have been particular conflicts within the Muslim community. And his message is that, yes, the Quran speaks of jihad, but the attacks against Islam today are not so much by the sword, but rather by the pen. That is, so the response should be a jihad by the pen. That is, a reasoned, intellectual, life-promoting, life-giving, thoughtful response to the needs of the world today. And so for him, that's the nature of what jihad is. It's showing, and both explaining and showing, the fundamentally merciful nature of the ideals of Islam.
And I think what you've just described is one of the real strengths of the book, that it can at once talk about traditional historical kinds of interpretations and contextualization, and also keep in mind that people have these contemporary real life lived experiences that help them understand what the text means. And, you know, at a certain level, these are very modern questions that, you know, we weren't alive 1400 years ago, so we're going to have different kinds of experiences, but there's still this kind of continuity, and I think the authors really articulate that well.
Yes, it was an extraordinary privilege to be in their company when they met with me, because these are people who are the intellectual giants of Islam in North America. So many of them I had the opportunity to meet with. And as I said, it was just extraordinary to be with them, because as I brought a sympathetic listening to this, to these conversations, a good number of them opened beyond just academic exchange, but people shared very personally about the meaning of the Quran, the meaning of their own faith. And it was just very memorable to be in their company. And I guess I would also say that it's one thing I learned in the course of this project was that we live in a time of great intellectual and spiritual vitality among Muslims in the United States. I think we could say, on the one hand, given the political realities of this time that we spoke about earlier, it's not easy to be a Muslim in the United States. Just try going through airport security. One of my conversation partners in the book, who is an African-American Muslim, put it this way. I drive black, but I fly Muslim. In other words, you're in trouble wherever you go. So it's difficult. But on the other hand, it's a very exciting time to be a Muslim intellectual at this moment in the U.S. I can make a comparison here. 100 years ago, if a guest in some city, say Chicago, were to tell his host that he wanted to attend a Catholic church, the host might respond, "Well, do you want Irish or German or Polish or Italian?" Because back then, churches were not simply religious institutions. They were also support centers for recent immigrants who were learning how to adapt to society in the United States. Today, however, such ethnic distinctions, I think, have largely diminished within Roman Catholicism, because uniquely American expressions of Catholicism have emerged. And it seems to me that such a change is underway among American Muslims now. Many mosques are still centers of ethnic identity, and helping recent immigrants to find their way in this society. But at the same time, the children and the grandchildren of those who arrived shortly after the changes in immigration laws in the 1960s that enabled much of our Muslim population in this country to come here, their children, their grandchildren may speak Urdu or Arabic to the older generation, but English is their first language. Ethnic and other identities are beginning to give way to what I believe are distinctly American expressions of Islam. Sunni and Shi'i may have been in conflict back home, but here in some communities, they worship together, because they say, you know, fundamentally the difference between us historically was who should run the political system in which we are living, and that's not an issue here. So why don't we get together and worship? There is even intermarriage on Sunni and Shiite. One person I had the opportunity to get to know described herself. She said, "My mother is Shi'i, my father is Sunni, and I'm Sushi." Only in America, perhaps. Huh? This is a place where Well, I met with an African American who serves as and who has served as an imam to a largely Bosnian masjid or mosque. Or I spoke with an Oklahoma-born convert to Islam who was trained at the great center in Egypt, Al-Azhar. He serves a community of Somali, Hispanic, and African American Muslims in the northeast of this country. In the past, a Pakistani Sufi and a Moroccan legal scholar might have met, if at all, only at the Hajj, only at the pilgrimage in Mecca. But here, they might live side by side. They might worship at the same mosque. So it's a time of rich interaction among Muslims with traditions from all over the world as they seek to respond to what are the unique possibilities and realities of life in the United States. And as a sympathetic outsider, I felt the excitement of this moment among American Muslims. So I think it's a tremendously dynamic moment in Muslim history right here, socially, spiritually, and intellectually. And it was amazing to be in the orbit of where that is happening.
Yeah, and I think that it's articulated well in the book that, you know, in the face of depressing and disheartening times, that it also opens an avenue for great things to happen and for important conversations to take place. And, you know, on that level, we sort of have to deal with the cards that are on the table, whether they got there through means that we like or don't like. And so you talk about this idea of American expressions of religion. And so in what sense do you think the Quran is an American text? And how do you think the volume speaks to that? And just as a side note, in my Quran class yesterday, we were talking about Thomas Jefferson's copy of the Quran and how Keith Ellison swore in on it. And so obviously the Quran has a little known history in the United States. But so how do you think this book plays into this idea of the Quran as an American text?
Texts, as I said earlier, come alive in communities, communities of interpretation. And I think the unique situation that exists here. One of my conversation partners said, you know, back in his, you know, grandparents' country, there was government support for Islamic institutions. However, that came with, shall we say, with strings attached. That came with an expectation of what was okay to criticize and what was not okay to criticize about the social situation that they were in. He said, you don't have that kind of sponsorship in the same way here in the United States, but instead you have a different kind of freedom to explore the layers and layers of meaning within the Quran that might have been impeded back in the old country. So that was what one of my conversation partners said. I think one thing that the Quran speaks to is the issues that are current within the United States, and those include questions of justice. Those include questions of gender justice. I was so fortunate to be able to speak with a good number of women scholars of Islam. A good number of them would, I believe, self-identify, and did so in the book, self-identify as feminist. I know that's a complicated term within the politics of Islam itself, but women who were looking at questions of the role of women, who are the women, what gets said about the rights of women, what is implied in the Quran. And I think that responds to the questions that are alive in this society in a different way than they would be elsewhere. And I just have to say it was amazing to be in the presence of such such brilliant minds, really, working with questions of social justice and gender justice. I think another related to the theme of justice, there is a vitality of interpretation within the African American. You have Muslims who came here recently and have been Muslim for centuries and are trying to figure out how to be American. On the other hand, you have people who have lived here for centuries, are fully American, even though they didn't come here voluntarily. They came here under the conditions of enslavement. They know very much how to be American because they've done that their whole lives. But their entrance, or in some cases re-entrance, into the Islamic community has been more recent. And so the a number of the African American voices that are represented in the volume speak about how they feel that this, how shall I say, just as in the classical period of Quranic interpretation, scholars were responding to the issues of their day and making the Quran come alive to the issues of that time, even though the Quran had already been present in the community for centuries. Likewise, here there are questions of justice, questions of how to be part of a society that has, on the one that is that espouses certain ideals and fails to live up to them, how to be a faithful Muslim in that context gives rise to new insights, interpretation that don't feel imprisoned by the by traditional modes of interpretation. They feel enriched by them, but they don't feel limited by them. And so to see that vitality as well was also very exciting.
So if we could follow up on this idea of social context and the issues of the day, as it were, to go back to this question of teaching, this is something that lots of us are dealing with and how to teach the Quran. And I mentioned earlier that I think the book strikes me as inherently focused on pedagogy in terms of its accessibility on the one hand, but also the depth and complexity that it explores at the same time. So could you say a little bit, how you've used this book in your teaching and what your challenges and successes have been with your students?
Certainly. Well, I think I'm in a unique situation being the person who put it together. And so it's still pretty new. And so for students, there's that kind of excitement of, here's the person who can give us the backstory. Here's the person who can fill in the gaps. So that's a unique situation for me. But I think the book lends itself well to a teaching context. Well, first of all, because these are based on conversations. And when people speak, sentences tend to be shorter and have beginnings, middles, and endings, and not lots of complicated footnotes. And so on the one hand, there's a readability here that makes it quite teachable. Although, as you pointed out, there are great riches, a great depths of sophistication in the interpretations that are offered here. students, my students, responded very positively to these commentaries. The words feel spoken, as in fact they were. The speakers are not, on the whole, are not hesitant to be personal. That opens up a kind of sense of connection with it. I think there are some commentaries that are a little more complicated than others, that require some sifting through together, just because they are they may presuppose a little more familiarity with some content in the Quran or some content with the Jewish and Christian scriptures, which is not as which is not to be presupposed for the contemporary, the current generation of college students. So some need some sifting through together, but my students found it very, very enriching. They wanted to know, how did I organize the book? Why did I put it in the particular order that it has? And I responded to them that was, in fact, a very exciting challenge for me as the shaper of this volume. I didn't want to, you know, you can think of lots of bad ways to organize the book. Here are the people that talk about topic A. Here are all the people that have ethnic background B. Here are all the people, and so forth. Here are all the women. Well, that would be a big chunk of the book. Here are all the progressives, if that word is meaningful. It's complicated. And instead, I tried to arrange the book in a way that there's not exactly an implied commentary by juxtaposition, but rather to hear these different voices that, in fact, are diverse, invites readers to see the breadth of ideas, the breadth of religious, spiritual, ethical understanding that is not only permitted within Islam, but in fact celebrated. One of my conversation partners in the book said to me that during the golden period, during the classical period of Islamic cultural flourishing, diversity, diverse opinions within the community was treasured as a sign of divine blessing. And to tell students that helps them to see that whatever you think came into the room thinking Islam is, it is broader than that. It is wider than that. And that, I think, itself is a valuable thing to learn.
Sure, and it's impossible, I think, to get any kind of different impression even from reading just a few of the chapters. And so if we could stay on this topic of teaching a little bit longer and organization, so when you, in terms of how you put the chapters together in order, how would you say, did you intend that to be the order in which it would be useful to teach the text from beginning to end? Do you have any advice for people that would like to teach the text in terms of how to incorporate selections?
Sure. Well, I think it might depend on what else they wanted. This might be part of a course that has other objectives, and they may want to choose selected portions of the text, because there's, you know, quite a bit going on here in the first 230 pages. But I began with, in fact, the very first conversation I had with Professor Ovamir Anjum, because he spoke about the opening surah, the opening verses of the Quran, and that seemed like a wonderful place to begin. But also his commentary on that opens a way of understanding an Islamic perception of what God is like, God's desire to communicate with humankind, what the notion of divine mercy is. And mercy as a theme runs through, I think, probably every chapter in this book. And so that was a wonderful place to begin. But he also spoke of the text in terms of what was immediately apparent and what was not immediately apparent. And so that lent itself to a chapter that I called Knowledge Hidden and Manifest, because a number of people with whom I met, for them, this became a theme. And for so many traditions, knowledge of God and the nature of knowledge is a wonderful place to begin. How do we know what we know? What is it possible for us to know? And that is related to the very process itself of reading. I love reading. I love reading in company. I love reading about reading. I love reading with readers who have read sacred texts. And so I continue with a chapter I called Close Readings, where people focus very intently upon a select portion of the Quran and show, in a way, I think, varieties of methods of reading, which I think kind of sets people up to understand that there can be such a variety of ways of approaching this sacred text. I continue with what I call living tradition, a chapter that looks at, again, at some traditional ways of understanding the sacred text. People who look to the modern world but are very rooted in traditional ways of reading. That seemed to lend itself to, well, how do you move from within the community, from within its historical self-understanding as a community of readers? How do you move beyond the community? And so there I looked at, or I gathered the voices, shall we say, of those who spoke about themes of encountering others outside of the Muslim community. And so you begin to have, in a sense, a transition there that from looking inward to looking outward. And that lends itself, I think, to the next chapter, which are people dealing with very contemporary concerns, whether it be violence, whether it be women's rights, whether it be racial justice, whether it be the environment. And then the next chapter completely is focused to questions of justice. And yet Islam is always both, like so many religious communities, both inward-looking and outward-looking. So I close with some people who both speak very intently of the inward life, Sufism is one expression of that within Islam. But I conclude with people who begin very much with that focus on the inward life and yet gather it with a profound concern for justice, whether that be justice, gender justice, social justice, economic justice. And so I conclude there with another set of, again, very warm and very inviting voices that point to other possibilities for meaning within the act of reading this holy text.
And I think in each section that you described too, you provide a nice introduction to it, explaining the thematic kinds of issues that the different authors are looking at. And so most of the book is exploring what these authors think, and your conclusion and your introduction are quite brief, but obviously you had a very big hand in terms of thinking about and conceptualizing and arranging this text and thinking about what the Quran means. And if I could, I'd like to ask you about the Quranic citation that you used to dedicate the volume, and you say, in tranquility, love, and compassion. And could you tell us what made you want to choose that verse to put at the beginning of the book over the other thousands of options you had to choose from?
Well, there were two reasons. One is that it captured a great deal of my experience of being a guest in the community of North American Muslims. I felt that compassion. I felt that love. I felt that tranquility, that inward peace, because of the depth of the hospitality that I experienced. And so that's one reason why it's there. The other reason why that verse is those words from that verse are mentioned there is because that's a verse that's talking about human love in marriage, and I dedicated the book to my wife. And so it has a meaning about the book, but also I think is self-disclosing about the quality of my own marriage.
Well, thanks for sharing your reflections about that. And we've taken up plenty of your time today. And before we conclude, I was hoping I could ask you about current or future projects that you're working on in terms of scholarship and whether or not they align with or depart from Quran and conversation. So could you tell us a little bit about these other projects?
Sure. I can mention a few things. Much of what I write about, as I mentioned at the beginning, is not about Islam at all. I am trained as a historian of Christianity, and over the last couple of decades, much of my focus, because of where I teach and whom I teach, has been focused, much of my focus has centered on my own religious community, the Quakers. I've written a number of books about Quaker theology and spirituality. I've just finished a piece where I make a case that the earliest Quaker community read more than people may have noted in the past, because I found connections, influences from translations of Jewish Kabbalistic texts among early Quakers. So that for me is lovely, because that suggests that kind. You can see my interest in interfaith connections, interfaith understanding. I'm also at work on a manuscript on Quaker soundings, if you will, Quaker readings of the biblical book entitled The Song of Songs. That's a collection of love poetry in the Bible that has been read and cherished by mystics, both within church and synagogue for millennia. And I'm looking at how my community has been part of that conversation of interpretation. As far as doing more with Islam, I'm waiting a little bit to see how the response is to this book within the Muslim community. So far, it has been very positive. I've received many unsolicited kind remarks from Muslims I know and Muslims I don't know about this. I could imagine doing something further, because it was such a joy to be a guest of the Muslim community and experience their warmth and hospitality, and to witness their intellectual and spiritual vibrancy. I don't know if this will go forth or not, but it seems to me if this first book has tried to look at something that's mostly misunderstood by non-Muslims, that is, what is the Quran and how is it read, it seems to me that another aspect of Islam that is widely misunderstood is how the Prophet Muhammad is understood as a role model within the community. There are many, many ways that Muhammad has been understood over the years. It would be fascinating to travel and speak within the American Muslim community and find out what of the many, many things that the Prophet Muhammad has meant for Muslims over the centuries. What dimensions of that particularly address the situation of American Muslims today? I don't know if that will happen or not. I'm going to wait and see, but that would be an exciting thing to do. Another dream project would be to meet with Muslims and not just be a listener, but to have more of an exchange, perhaps not on scriptural texts, but on other inspiring texts of spiritual depth, looking at, I'll give you an example. There are two, in the late 19th and early 20th century, there was someone from my community, Rufus Jones, widely read outside of the Quaker community, particularly in the English-speaking Protestant community, wrote about the mystical life and wrote very much about how to respond to questions of modernity, how to embrace the insights of contemporary psychology in the religious life, how to engage in justice and concerns for making society peaceful. He was pretty much a direct contemporary of the great Turkish scholar Bediüzzaman Said Nursi, who shared many of those same concerns. It would be wonderful to meet with the scholar of Said Nursi, have that person teach me about Said Nursi. I teach that person about Rufus Jones and what happens between us. One of the people I met with was a scholar of Khwaja Mir Dard, 18th century person living in the South Asian subcontinent, responding to questions of British colonialism and justice, but also very much a mystic. I wrote a book on John Woolman, who was a Quaker mystic abolitionist, social reformer of the 18th century, from a different angle, but also responding with profound questions about human justice, responding to the issues brought about by British colonialism. What kind of exchange could happen there? I think that would be very exciting if that could happen, but that would require leisure on the part of not just myself but others and interest in this project. If that were to happen, I would find that terribly stimulating, I think. So those are two ideas, but I'll have to say that 5 years ago I would never have imagined doing this project. So I don't know what the future holds for me. I'm willing to be guided, and I hope that the future will be as exciting as this project was for me.
Yeah, well, these all sound like very exciting projects, and certainly from everything I can gather, you seem to be the person or a person who would be absolutely qualified to undertake these ambitious sorts of things. And thank you so much for sharing your time with us, Professor Burkle. I look forward to continuing to assign the book, Quran and Conversation, in my classes and have already had success with that. And I hope our listeners can benefit from the strategies that you've discussed pedagogically as well. And thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
Well, thank you for inviting me to be your guest. I wish you the best in your work as a teacher and a scholar. I wish you much happiness and contentment, and perhaps our paths will cross again. Thank you so much.
Look forward to it. Thank you.
That was my conversation with Michael Burkle, professor of religion at Earlham College, about his exciting edited volume, Quran in Conversation, published by Baylor University Press in 2014. Thanks for listening.